From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, voodoo. Lots going on tonight. Here's what's happening. The Senate Intelligence Committee is aiming to regulate a Pentagon UFO program so that you, the public, is better informed of its activities and the country's intelligence branches can more easily share information. What an amazing story. The panel said that it supports the efforts of the Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon Task Force, officially confirming the program's continued existence in a provisional to the Manual of Intelligence Authorization. That's incredible. The governors from New York, Connecticut, and New Jersey have announced that individuals traveling to the tri-state area from states experiencing a surge in the COVID-19 cases will be required to self-quarantine there for 14 days. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy, in a virtual joint press conference, announced a joint travel advisory, which will go into effect at midnight, that will require individuals traveling from states including Arkansas, Alabama, Arizona, South Carolina, Texas, Florida, North Carolina, Utah, and the state of Washington to quarantine for 14 days. Analysis say there's at least a 1 in 3 chance that at least one of four major risks will occur within the next decade. A major influenza pandemic killing more than 2 million people, a global catastrophe of volcanic eruptions, a major solar flare, we've talked a lot about that, or a global war. If the time frame is 2 decades, then there's a 56% chance that one of these disasters will occur, according to the analyst, based on various studies and risk assessments. Earthquakes were omitted from the numbers on the grounds that they were more local events. Let's check in with Howard Bloom, our local expert on such matters. Howard, your take on the continuing saga of the COVID-19?
Well, here's the deal. The coronavirus is going to be with us for a long time to come. It's going to get worse before it gets better. And in fact, it may get worse 3 or 4 times and may be with us for a full 2 years. But there's one surefire way to stop it, if and only if the White House makes a vital change in policy. But first, the latest news. Things are worse than you've been told. The United States leads the world in coronavirus deaths. In fact, the USA has now had more coronavirus deaths than the next 4 countries combined. Yes, we've had more coronavirus deaths than England, Russia, Brazil, and India put together. No wonder the European Union is planning to close its doors to American travelers. Our country is now the greatest coronavirus infection factory in the world. Roughly 25,000 Americans like you and me die of the coronavirus every month. In just 2 months, the virus kills more Americans than are killed by auto accidents in a full year. And in just 3 months, the coronavirus kills more Americans than normal flu kills in a year. The virus is advancing in 19 states. 7 states are reporting the highest totals of coronavirus hospitalizations since the pandemic began. Now, that's hospitalizations, not cases. It's not a fiction created by testing and exaggerated by the mainstream media. It's a life-threatening reality. The virus is making its greatest inroads in Texas, California, and Florida, and those states contain 27.4% of America's population. According to the Associated Press, coronavirus cases are surging in particular among the young, among people 18 to 49 years old. And the virus may get far, far worse. Why? Because countries like South Korea, Vietnam, Taiwan, and New Zealand have kept their death tolls down to nearly 1/400th of ours, which means that for every death in these countries, we've had nearly 400 deaths. There's a reason. The secret weapon that stops the coronavirus in its tracks is testing. Testing and isolating those who are infected with the coronavirus so they can't infect others. With testing and isolation, the sort of rallies that the president has had in Oklahoma and Arizona are perfectly safe. Without testing and isolation, those rallies can be super spreaders. Each rally can endanger thousands of lives. In fact, according to the Associated Press, new coronavirus hotspots are now being traced to reopened funerals, fitness classes, churches, restaurants, and bars. Our president has said that we've tested more citizens than any other nation on earth. Now, according to the BBC's fact checkers, that's true, but our timing has been off. Last week, I used the image of a Babe Ruth with a ferocious swing, waiting to take that swing until after the ball is in the catcher's mitt. If you don't swing at the right time, no matter how powerful your swing may be, you won't hit a home run. In fact, you won't hit the ball at all. When it comes to testing and isolation, we swung too late. That's why we are so far behind the rest of the world in coronavirus protection. But there is a way to make up for that. Test everyone, do it now, and isolate all of us who test positive, even if those who test positive are you and me. To test every American citizen in just 1 month would take 11 million tests per day. That would take central coordination, it would take a budget, and it would take a leader who sees the urgent need for testing. Unfortunately, the White House is moving in the opposite direction. The president told his Oklahoma rally audience on Saturday that he had asked his people to slow down the testing, and he said Tuesday that by having more tests, we have more cases. That approach may kill another 100,000 Americans.
Well, but the one thing is, Howard, we cannot shut this country down again, no matter what. And I wish we'd do a better job explaining exactly where this COVID-19 came from. We still believe in a laboratory in China, but nobody's talking about that anymore. A federal court has moved to dismiss charges against ex-National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, one of President Trump's associates convicted. Flynn, a former three-star general, was the highest-ranking official snared by that special counsel inquiry into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. The ruling came as a prosecutor told Congress, Aaron Zelensky, that he was pressured to go easy on longtime aide Roger Stone. Roger has been sentenced to 40 months in jail for election-related crimes. I've got Roger Stone on the line with us right now. Roger, first, I want your reaction to this Flynn situation, then we'll talk about you.
Well, unfortunately, breaking news here, Judge Emmett Sullivan this evening has refused to dismiss the case against General Flynn and has put a stay on any motions in the case. He's hoping to take the case en banc to get the entire D.C. appeals court, so he is not throwing in the towel. Now, I'm a great supporter of General Flynn. I think he's a great American. This was an illegitimate, fraudulent investigation. The same people who attempted to crucify him are the people who are crucifying me and tried to bring down the president. This is an illegal cabal that never had a legitimate beginning. But our cases are very similar. There is FBI misconduct in both cases. We have the same politicized, agenda-driven liberal prosecutors whose real goal is not to ensnare General Flynn or Roger Stone, but to get one of us to turn on the president, which, of course, I was given the opportunity to do, and I refused. People don't really understand where my case is, but it's really kind of urgent. I'm facing a deep state death sentence by being forced to report to a prison where the coronavirus is a very real danger.
Yeah.
Next Tuesday, the 30th. A lot of people think that because I filed an emergency motion with Judge Amy Berman Jackson and the DOJ did not oppose my action, that I will get a 60-day a delay in surrender. That is not necessarily the case. This is now up to Judge Jackson. She has been extraordinarily hostile to me. She attacked me during my sentencing, accusing me of crimes that I did not commit, said that I was convicted of covering up for Donald Trump. That was not one of the charges. Said that there was nothing phony about the Mueller investigation. Well, we now know, thanks to these declassified documents and the great work of Rick Grenell, who's acting DNI director, that that's wrong, that this was a fraudulent investigation from the beginning. So if the judge rules against my motion in the next 4 days, I would be ordered to go to a prison where at 67 years old and with asthma, I am a prime candidate to die from the coronavirus. Now, here's the really incredible part, George. The Attorney General bars directives to the Bureau of Prisons that nonviolent prisoners, inmates be transferred from prison to home confinement, mm-hmm. which applied to Michael Avenatti, the Democrat super lawyer who stole $25 million, applied to Michael Cohen, the former Trump lawyer who became a Mueller witness against the president, and Rick Gates, Paul Manafort's former partner, who testified falsely against me. But then they told us last Thursday it doesn't apply to Roger Stone. I'm older than all of them, and I think my health, while it's generally good, I have these underlying problems. The court is well aware of them. So this is a purposeful death sentence. Was it my book, The Bush Crime Family, or my book, The Clinton's War on Women, exposing both of them? Was it my 30-year, 40-year friendship with Donald Trump? Or was it the fact that I refused to flip, that they just told me that if I would recharacterize, if I would re-remember my some 29 phone calls between candidate Trump and I in 2016 during the election, that they would recommend no jail time? And I refused to do that. So at this juncture, there is only one person who can grant me relief if Judge Jackson does, as I think she will probably do, and denies my motion for a delay. And that is the President of the United States. He can order a commutation of my sentence on humanitarian grounds as an act of mercy, because I am looking at a death sentence. There is no question about that.
Raj, do you think he will do this before or after the election? I think he's going to do something. I just don't know when.
I cannot survive 5 months exposed to coronavirus.
No, that's true.
The prison guards union at the prison in Jessup, Georgia, where I have been ordered, has already said publicly that there are no precautions being taken and has accused the Bureau of Prisons of underreporting cases. There's a terrific piece in USA Today that criticized the entire Bureau of Prisons for their not being forthright about how many prisoners actually have this terrible virus, and for their lack of being prepared and their lack of transparency. So they've cut off all visiting at Jessup, which is interesting. Now, Aaron Zelinsky said that I got special treatment. That's actually what he said. You know, he's absolutely right. I did get special treatment.
You got harsh treatment. Harsh treatment.
29 FBI agents show up at your house pre-dawn, heavily clad in SWAT gear and carrying assault weapons. That's special treatment.
Yeah,
and they roust you out of bed at 6 o'clock in the morning for nonviolent process crimes, and you have no previous criminal record. That's special treatment. When they accuse you of being a flight risk, when you don't even have a valid passport and you don't own a firearm, and then they don't ask for a cash bond when they arraign you, that's special treatment. When Mueller, Brennan, Clapper, Rosenstein, McCabe, Strzok, Page, Hillary, you can, this list goes on forever, when they lie to Congress about material things, things that matter, but they are not charged, yet I am charged with lying to Congress about totally immaterial things that hid no underlying crime. Yes, that's being treated specially. And now, as I just said, when Michael Avenatti, Michael Cohen, Rick Gates, all of these anti-Trump rats are given home confinement, but Roger Stone is sent to a death sentence, yes, I'm getting special treatment, no question about it.
Stay safe, Roger, and keep in touch with us, and we'll all say a prayer for you. You're going through some rough times for sure. Roger's website, stonezone.com. The CDC says 368 people have reported getting sick since last May, bringing this year's total to 465 poultry-related salmonella cases reported in 42 states. That's about twice as many as reported at the same time last year. GNC has filed for bankruptcy and warning it will close up to a quarter of its stores in search for a buyer. The 85-year-old vitamin and dietary supplement company has been saddled with $1 billion of debt, declining sales at its brick-and-mortar store locations. A 5.8 earthquake rattles Central California. If you live in Cali, did you feel it? More people are likely to experience a tension headache at some point. They can develop at any age, but are more common in teenagers and adults. Women tend to suffer from them more commonly than men. What's going on with these headaches? Here's Dr. Peter Bregan. Peter, what's up with these things?
Well, I think one of the most important things is they're not disabling. If you have a headache, like a migraine, that is really making it hard for you to live or work or carry on, then you need to see a doctor. We're talking now in terms of these tension headaches with stuff that's affecting the muscles usually. Head, neck, and shoulders, pressure around the head or the sides of the head from these muscles. And so there's good news right away, which is it's not coming from your brain. So so people can relax and not get all just frightened by it. That's very, very important.
And stay off the drugs, right, Doc?
Oh, absolutely. That was going to be my conclusion, which is, you know, all pain meds cause rebound because the brain fights against medication. So if you're taking something to suppress pain, you're going to get more and more pain. And so stay away from the drugs. I have a suggestion that for people that I haven't seen anywhere, really, which is if you're having these frequently, work with somebody you care about, a friend at the office, your wife, your husband, you know, somebody in the family, and get gentle massage of your head and neck and shoulders. And people can learn to do that on a video and work with the person to make sure it's comforting and comfortable. And more than the massage itself, or maybe not more, but just as much as the massage, the attention, the caring can help relieve the tension. We used to talk about the laying on of the hands, George, in medicine. I don't hear much of that anymore.
Well, that's true, but it works. Dr. Peter Breggin, his website, Breggin, great psychiatrist, folks. How does vote by mail work, and does it increase election fraud? In a moment, Bev Harris joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Lots of talk these days about states moving to vote by mail because of the COVID-19 health risks. And also, of course, we had heard that Georgia had a spectacular collapse of its voting system. So we thought it's time to bring in Bev Harris from Black Box Voting. Bev, of course, explains the voting system, what works, what doesn't. Bev, I think we're on the verge of a mess. What do you think?
Oh, dear. You're right. I'm really concerned about this one, I think, more than I ever have been before, and it's just bad. Where do you want me to start? Definitely the vote by mail is a big topic, and the Georgia meltdown is a big topic, and what's going to happen in November is another big topic.
Well, absolutely. Well, first of all, I think COVID's going to be well with us well into the November 3rd election. So what does that mean?
Well, that does create some challenges, although it's being handled in some interesting ways. Some of the locations that aren't huge urban locations are handling it with drive-through voting. You know, you can drive through your pharmacy and pick up a prescription, and lots of people have all kinds of diseases when they do that, but it's relatively safe. And so that would be a way to get around the big risks of the mass vote by mail, and get also around some of the risks of the contagion of the virus. One of the worst things you want to do is have these touch screens or these ballot marking devices where everybody's sticking their finger on the machine.
Yeah,
the same
exactly.
Machine. That's not right. Or standing in lines together for hours and hours. So it takes some thought. But I will say that mass vote by mail is actually not the best answer. The problem is it deals with the virus problem, but it cannot, when it's done en masse, unrestricted, it cannot deliver a credible election.
And what do you think of voting by digital phone? Just simply staying at home and just, you know, toot, 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 that's who I voted for.
Well, that's got the same problems and maybe even some more than the vote by mail. All the remote voting techniques have, it's kind of a different set of worms than the ones when you go to the polling place with the touchscreen. The problem with remote voting is counterfeit ballots and votes that never make it into the system, missing ballots. And then they'll say, well, we'll audit the count. Well, it doesn't matter what you audit. If you've got counterfeit ballots and you've got votes that are missing, or you didn't.
And which ones do you allow and which ones do you not?
Right. And what the big problem is with vote by mail, people have an understanding of what they think vote by mail is. No. What they're talking about now is a complete restructuring of how it's done, and they've disabled the safeguards. For example, in states like mine, Washington State, they were using a signature comparison to validate your ballot. Now, there's a lot of problems with that because they're actually not looking at the signature. They're just using a software program that was provided by some middleman. But setting that all aside, they've decided to ditch the signatures. For example, in Georgia, they decided, well, we've got these thousands and thousands of vote-by-mail ballots and the signatures don't match, and so we're going to go to court and we want to count them. And the courts ruled, sure, you can count them whether the signatures match or not.
Wow.
If you do that, you can dump thousands of counterfeit ballots into the system just using some, you know, names of people who hardly ever vote.
Bev, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk more about this. We'll take phone calls next hour. How you folks vote, check in with us next hour on that. Did you know in the 2016 election, a quarter of the U.S. votes, 33 million, were cast by either universal mail or absentee ballots? And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Bev Harris with us as we talk about elections and the mess with all the voting situations. Exactly, Bev, what happened in Georgia?
Well, Georgia is sort of like if you take everything that can go wrong with an election and you mix it up in a dish, that's Georgia. Three big problems. One is they decided to buy the very voting machine that everybody, all of the experts, advised them not to buy. And by the way, it costs five times as much as the other model, which they were recommended to buy, and it produces long lines. The only reason I can think of for that is either someone wanted to cheat with it or kickbacks, because it doesn't make any kind of sense otherwise. So they bought these voting machines. They didn't work particularly well. They produced long lines. Then they also, the second problem was even a bigger problem. They bought a whole bunch of electronic poll books, which means you go and you check in to vote, and it authenticates that you're on the list.
It's like almost like Kindle, huh?
Pardon?
It's almost like a Kindle unit, isn't it? Something
right.
like that?
And it's fine, except they had no paper backup for it. And so, as happened, they didn't have enough, and a whole bunch of those crashed. And so people were standing in line for hours, I believe, some of them as long as till midnight, because they couldn't get checked in. So that was a snafu, and then some. And then the last thing is they couldn't come up with the results or the accounting for the results, which is a very serious problem, which I think we're going to be looking at in November in even a bigger way. Basically, people would go in and they would say, well, we have 100% of the precincts reporting. And then they would find out, but actually they only had 60% of the votes in 100% of the precincts. And so people would say, well, wait a minute, how many votes have you counted and how many have you not counted? And they would not give them those numbers. Essentially, they hid the results for more than a week.
Jeez. And now, has their election even been validated?
You know, I'm not completely sure on that yet. They do have a period of time after which they certify it, but it's always a problem. The way that things should come in, these things are electronic, which means the minute those votes are scanned, you can produce a tape with a result on it, and you can get these interim results along the way, and that commits the data so that as you make adjustments later on, you can account for the adjustments and provide documentation. You don't want to just say, we're not going to tell you what they are, and then we're just going to have a week to tinker with it. That's a bad idea, but that's what they did. They just would not give up the results. Now, many, many states, the election officials are now saying they are not planning on giving up all their results for as much to a week after the election.
Ooh. We're used to, we want instant numbers. We want them right away.
Well, the thing is, even if you don't have all of them, there is no reason whatsoever you can't be giving interim batch results. In other words, you run a batch of votes, and you post that result, and then you run the next batch, and you post that, and people can see it as it goes. That's perfectly feasible with all the systems. So they've decided they just don't want to do that, and they want to withhold that information and just for up to a week, and then just sit on it. Well, obviously what that does is they don't have to then account for any adjustments they're making, and they can literally tinker with the votes in the dark.
And, Bev, who's right, the president or Twitter, where he says vote by mail is used to cheat? Twitter says that's not true.
The president is right. When they say it's not true, they're thinking of the old methods of vote by mail, which had safeguards. The new method, not only are they not comparing signatures, but they are also ballot harvesting, which means you can go around and collect stacks of ballots. You could go and collect a stack of 1,000 ballots from heaven knows whom, in whoever's name, and dump them into a drop box, and they would be counted. So the chain of custody is just toast. So the new methods of vote by mail that they're planning to implement is a mass vote by mail. The difference is whether it's controlled vote by mail or it's mass vote by mail. When you have mass unrestricted vote by mail, it's done completely differently, and the safeguards are stable. So he's right.
How come this president doesn't get any credit for anything like this? Because when he says things like this, everyone thinks he's conspiratorial and everything else. And here we are talking to you, an expert on voting, and you're saying he's right.
You know, I'm so glad he did that. I know he takes tremendous heat for it. I actually was watching the day he did, and I had been talking to everybody I could find, everybody in power, explaining where the problems are with this new system. And it was so refreshing, because he maybe does it not the most artfully that you could possibly do, not the most elegantly, but it needed to be said. We needed to get that dialogue going. And he's absolutely right. And I see all these editorials and so-called experts come out and they say, well, it really is safe. They're talking about the stuff we did in the 1800s with vote by mail. They're not talking about the mass vote by mail rollout they're doing right now where it's all computerized.
What he needs to do.
I know how that system works. I have the software. I've seen exactly how it works, and it's not what they think it is.
What would have happened, Bev, had he made that same statement, but had someone like you flanking him, giving the expert opinions to the news media about what he just said?
The news media would not have reported it.
You don't think so? Really?
Nope.
They like the controversy, then.
You know, I will tell you that he talks a lot about fake news, but a lot of it was not a surprise to me because I've been doing this since 2002, and I've been very surprised at some of the blackout of information that you get from the news media. You can flat out do something, they can witness it, and they will not report it because they feel they have a duty to make elections sound trustworthy. Well, they have to be trustworthy, not just sound trustworthy. And we can get them that way, but not if we don't have a dialogue about it.
What are the odds, honestly now, of a canceled November 3rd national election?
I don't think it's going to be canceled.
You don't think it'll be postponed at all, a month, a week,
no,
or something?
I don't think it will be. But I do think that we're going to have a problem with delayed counting, which is very concerning.
Well, if it's a close race.
A lot of shenanigans probably on both sides.
So what's going to happen, Bev?
Each side lobbying accusations against the other. And you see, the reason I say that's preventable is if you make it transparent and you account for things properly and promptly, then you don't have that problem. But when they start saying we're going to count, you know, and then we're not going to tell anyone, and then a week later, and we're not going to check the signatures, you leave yourself wide open to all kinds of litigation and contests.
If it's a close race, the loser is going to contest this election.
Yep.
So how long will that take before they go back and check everything state by state?
You know, we went through that in 2000, and this would be worse because there was an election in 2004 in Washington State, the governor's election between Rossi and Gregoire. Do you know that 6 months later they were still litigating, and the guy, they finally resolved the court case after 4 years when the election had, the governor had already run her entire term. This is not good at all. It's terrible for the stock market too, by the way. They like certainty. And that, I think there's things that can be done. Now with Georgia, there's a group called the Coalition for Good Governance. And if you go to Twitter or whatever, you'll find that. And they are dealing with litigating Georgia elections to get them cleaned up a bit. So Coalition for Good Governance in Georgia. And I can't stress enough that it's important for anybody, any person, any group to get out there and start demanding the numbers, start right away, and then keep on them, and then report it publicly when they're hiding the numbers from you.
Well, yeah, we saw what happened just in Florida then in 2000 with those hanging chads when George W. Bush was running against Al Gore.
They found all kinds of things. Like in Volusia County, they had 16,000 negative votes. In other words, they had votes and then they minused them out and they said, oh, they were negative. You know, how do you have negative votes? And so, yeah, that was an election that statewide was only separated by 500 votes. So when you have 16,000 minus votes, that's a bit odd. But that happens when people demand to see the numbers, and that's what I think is going to have to happen. We've got to get right out of the gate and not accept this business about we can't tell you what it is or we don't know. I'm hearing a new word. It's called the word fluid, and they're saying the numbers are fluid. No. Numbers of votes should not be fluid after Election Day.
Previous shows.
Ballots you've mailed. If you're waiting for a few to come back in, you have a finite number there that you can work with. It's a range, but it's a number. And that was a big thing in Georgia. They were saying, well, the numbers are fluid. We just can't tell you. We don't know how many ballots are outstanding. We don't know how many we've counted. It's fluid. And that's what I expect to see this fall. And we have to be very, very tough on that, everybody.
Bev, in previous shows, we talked about the Diebold machines. I don't hear you talking about them much anymore. Are they still around?
The biggest company is Election Systems and Software. They bought the Diebold system.
Oh, they did. Okay.
Yeah, and they also had their own big system. So they have about 66% of all the voting systems in the United States. And some of the old Diebold stuff is still going to be counting this election, but they'll be doing it under the name of Election Systems and Software.
This huge company, do they lean politically anyway?
You know, I that doesn't really float my boat, just trying to guess which party they want to do. Every activist who is a Democrat thinks they lean Republican and vice versa. If I had to guess, I would say that it's whatever the local power structure is, because people want to control their local elections and their county elections because there's literally billions of dollars in contracts. So the mayor, the sheriff, the DA, the judges, all that stuff is very heavily in contention as well. There's no question that the systems are sort of open for business. They're sort of designed to be that way. But I think it's a stretch to indicate that the company itself favors a particular party on the national level.
There's a writer by the name of Daryl West on behalf of the Brookings Institute, and he writes about mail-in. He says, there is no evidence that mail ballots increase electoral fraud. Several anti-fraud protections are built into the process. Plus, those who abuse mail ballots can be charged with election fraud and face fines or prison time.
I'm thinking that might be the guy I was having an argument with him on Twitter today, and he finally just went away because he couldn't answer. I said, so tell me what the safeguards are, and we'll check and see whether they're still in use. And he couldn't tell me any of them, because every single thing that they used to rely on to prevent fraud has been disabled. That's the problem. And you cannot go and say, well, this is what we did, you know, back in 1950, and it worked. Well, that's not at all how they're doing it. For example, they intake all these ballots. First of all, it used to be you would fill out an application for a mail-in ballot. That's a paper trail, right?
That's right.
And you could actually go and see how many people had filled out this. Well, the new method, they send them to you whether you ask for it or not. So they just willy-nilly go through the list. Now, the list sometimes has up to, in one county in California, there were more than 1 million names on the list that were inactive, had moved away, had died, and they're just mailing the ballots out to them. You know, well, if you have this huge slush fund of ballots that are floating around and they're ending up in dumpsters, and what my concern is they know they have, you can buy a change of address list from the post office, but they don't take those people off the voter list. So if you were working at the ballot printer and you're an operative, you already know who the people are that you could use their ballots and they would never know because they've moved. And so you would just print a bunch of extra. They would never go through the mail. They would just be counterfeited and submitted in a drop box.
Bev, what recommendations would you, an expert on voting machines and voting systems, do to preserve the 2020 election?
Well, first of all, I would put a lid on the vote by mail. I would keep the signature match requirement. I would get rid of the ballot harvesting concept. It should be, you know, one person bringing one ballot and putting it either into the post office or the drop box, not thousands or hundreds at a time. So basically keeping the old style safeguards on vote by mail. And secondly, keeping vote by mail minimized to those who need it. I don't mind that they have it, but it should be for those who need it. And there's no reason they can't fill out an application for it. And then I do think if the virus is going hot and heavy, as much as possible, the drive-in voting or the drive-through voting, I think, is a really appealing concept, because you can have all of the safeguards of ID and everything else, real person getting the ballot, real time. I really like that idea. With the bigger metro areas, they have to have a lot more stations, and they have to have a lot more, you know, sanitary types of procedures and distancing procedures. It can be done. Now, Wisconsin did it, and they had vote in person right during the peak of the virus, and they did not have a big outbreak afterwards because they followed really good, the social distancing and the sanitizing measures. So it can be done. So I think we don't just, you know, throw everything out, try to start all anew, and we have to, you know, use the safeguards that have worked for us in the past. And then we have to really be alert as citizens. They won't always do what you ask them to do, like if you're telling them, I want to know what the numbers are. But your remedy there is to expose that. That's, you know, we have social media now, and that does put a lot of pressure on them, and that does make them come up with those numbers a lot of times. And once you have the numbers, then you can start spotting any anomalies and go to work on them.
Yeah, Bev, with regards to COVID-19, why don't we just do what the mob does and say, forget about it, and just do everything the way we were doing it, and just forget about it?
You know, it's not as big a problem as they make it. I'm senior, right? So I'm in a high-risk group. There's no reason why you can't have the people who are in a high-risk group apply for a mail-in vote, have the signature verification, and going on. That caps the risk, though, so that you're not talking about 70% of the ballots. You're talking about, 15% of the ballots.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing you can do. And then you can certainly just use common sense about how you set up the polling places. It can be done, and it has been done by several places during this spring.
Well, I hope they don't do it like the DMV.
Outbreak.
The DMV, where you get your car licensed and your driver's license renewed, is a disaster in many states. People who've been waiting, and if we can get some of you to call us, if you've been to the DMV offices since you've been having this COVID-19 situation, people have waited in line when they're open, and the lines are all the way down the sidewalk, and they let two people in at a time, and then it's a mess.
That's why the drive-through is a better option, I think, because it keeps it moving. Basically, you drive through and pick up your ballot, and you drive to the next station and drop it off after you filled it out. They have actually, when they've had that, they actually have groups that provide rides to people to do that if they want to do that. So it's, I actually think it's kind of a good idea.
How many Americans generally vote during a presidential election?
It can be as high as 70%, 45% if people are very uninterested in it. But generally, it can be 70%.
Well, what are we talking, though, about 100 million people?
Yeah, it's a couple hundred million.
Okay, stay with us, Bev. We're going to take calls with you when we come back. If you've been in a voting booth, tell us what it's been like. If you had to wait in line at a DMV, tell us what it's been like.